Welcome to Pete's Pub. I'm your host, Pete Kemmerer. This is episode 11, release date Sunday, August 31st, 2025. For the first 10 episodes of this podcast, I was either talking about my life or I was interviewing someone who I find interesting. Well, today I get to do a little of both as I'm joined by Jason Nugent, who I was introduced to back in 2001 and who quickly became a friend, mentor, and a huge part of my life for a good 10 years. He's a multi-talented fellow out of Canada that I have sadly gotten a bit out of touch with, but I'm not past using this podcast to try to remedy that a bit. Jason, welcome to Pete's Pub.
Thank you for having me, Pete. And you are right. It has been far too long since we have connected.
I know. And you're one of the people in my life that could really make me laugh. It's just, I don't know, your sense of humor was always something special to me. It's funny, the two people in my life who made me laugh the most are both kind of geeky people. You know, you were the computer geek from Canada that taught me all about Linux and how to, with lots of help, administer Linux servers. And then another fellow who worked for me at NEAPCO is another one who made me pull off the side of the road and laugh. So thank you for your sense of humor. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. Did I meet the other fellow when I was visiting you that one time?
I think you might have, yes. His name's Tim Oyster.
Okay, yeah, I remember Tim. I think so. Yeah, Tim. It's been a long time, but yeah.
Very funny guy and his dry sense of humor. We still meet once a month on Wednesdays. In fact, I'll be seeing him tomorrow as I record this. Be seeing him tomorrow for lunch. So we still have our time together and try to have a laugh in these trying times without getting into it too deeply.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. Yeah. Are you still in Fredericton, New Brunswick up there?
I still am. I've been here, you know, like when I moved to Fredericton, I moved back to New Brunswick in 2004. I was only supposed to be here a year because I was replacing a guy who was on a one-year leave of absence as a systems administrator at the University of New Brunswick. And lo and behold, I no longer work at the university. I haven't worked there for coming up on, I think, 14 years now. But I'm still in Fredericton, still here, still in the same house. This was the second house that I had after I moved back to Fredericton. And I love it here. Absolutely love it here. It's about 3 hours from where I grew up. I grew up in a place called Bathurst, which is just in the northern part of the province. Grew up kind of rural on the outskirts of Bathurst in a little village called North Tettigush. These are all stories that I think everybody born in the 70s and the 80s can relate to, like your 40-minute bus ride to school in the morning, standing in the snow, waiting for the school bus to come, walking uphill both ways to get to and from work and home. And yeah, and just, I stayed in Bathurst in New Brunswick until I finished high school in the early 90s and then moved to Halifax, studied chemistry and math there, and then worked as a chemist at Brunswick Mines and in Toronto again as an industrial water treatment chemist until kind of the mid-90s, and then moved back to Halifax and then got sucked into the gaming world, the video gaming world, really, started working with Stomped, which was something we can talk about for sure. And then that ultimately led me to you.
Sure. That was the path, I suppose. I still use your pick from way back in 2009 as my desktop background.
Really? The skyline of Fredericton.
Yes. You're talking about how you love it up there. Well, that picture, I can't not use it. It's so beautiful. I mean, it's
I'm
just
glad you
best.
Like it.
And I'll share a link to that in the show notes so that people know what I'm talking about, because obviously we're on an audio podcast here. But it's a gorgeous pick, and I invite you all to steal it and use it.
I hope everybody does steal it. Like, I mean, yeah, I was at that point in my life, I was starting to get really into photography and take it seriously. And I was carrying a camera with me everywhere I went. And what would Bob Ross call it? A happy accident. I was walking home from work, and there's a walking bridge that spans the Wollastook River in Fredericton, colonial name, St. John River. And it's just, it was right around when the sun was setting. And so it was sometime in the winter and the water was frozen. And as a sunset shot that I still look at it and think, yeah, that's sometimes you make good art, you know, by accident.
Oh, yeah. It's it really is stunning. It has a lasting appeal to me. I mentioned before the podcast, I just got a brand new M4 MacBook Air. And you know, first thing I did was make sure that my background pick was correct when I restored from my my Time Machine backup. And it's like, there it is. Yes.
How did you find Time Machine this time?
Time Machine, I think Time Machine is great. I think everybody who has a Mac is very lucky because it really does, it makes the whole process of, you know, moving from one computer to a brand new computer very, very easy. There were three or four things I had to do manually afterward, but by and large, it just worked. And this time I went, you know, this is geeky stuff, but the first half of this podcast will be geeky. That's okay. You're going from an Intel machine to an ARM-based machine, the Apple Silicon, and it didn't miss a beat. It was great, and like I say, 99% of my stuff just worked out of the box, which I found amazing. I lost nothing.
That's good to know. I briefly flirted with Mac in the kind of mid-2000s and got disillusioned when a MacBook Pro I had died like 10 weeks or 1 week out of warranty kind of thing. And I was like, oh, this sucks. So I switched to Windows, which I never thought I would ever hear myself saying, but I did.
Me neither.
And, yeah, I know, right? And I've been using, I have two laptops now. I've got a Linux laptop for day-to-day stuff, and all my photo work is done on Windows now. But
yeah,
it's nice to know that the Mac stuff is good. I've heard good things about the M4.
Yeah, it's very fast. It handles all this podcast stuff very well. And it's cool. As long as you're with the MacBook Air, of course, there's no fans in the machine. So if you're going to be doing like super heavy duty video editing and stuff like that on the local machine, well, that could be a problem. But or CAD work, for instance, you know, if they even had a decent CAD program out other than AutoCAD for Mac. But other than that, it's just great. I have no issues with it. And everything just flies compared to the Intel that I had, which was only 6 years old, but 6 years in computer years is like 42 years or something like that. So
exactly. Was that Star Trek episode where they pull Scotty out of a transporter and he's like, what happened? I was only stuck for like 30 years or something. And nothing's the same on the Enterprise.
Nothing's the same. Yeah.
Don't touch anything.
So you mentioned Stomp.com. Tell people a little bit about what Stomp was all about.
Oh my God. Stomp. So Stomp was one of maybe a handful of kind of the preeminent video game news sites based around first-person shooters. So if you think of the stuff that id Software and Epic Mega Games created back in the 90s and the 2000s, games like Quake, the original Doom, which was kind of the groundbreaking game for everybody, I think, that remembers it, Quake 2, Quake 3, Unreal Tournament, Unreal Tournament, was it 2003, I think, was the next one? Anyway, all those games had a huge fan base of people who played them. And Stomped was one of the sites that they went to looking for video game news. And, like, do you know the origin of Stomped? Like, where the actual sites started from? Like, the original people behind
it? No, I don't remember.
Okay, so the original Stomped, and any omissions and things that I miss are my mistakes alone, because I'm doing this from memory. But the original Stomped was created by a guy, aptly named Guy Gustafson, from Minneapolis. And he was a very big dude. He was a huge guy, something like 6'6", 6'7", like massive dude. And he played by the video game handle Bigfoot. And he started an internet service provider company called Stomped Internet. And Sean Martin Redwood ran Redwood's News, which was a dedicated site specifically for Quake. And Sean had the honor of knowing the guys at id Software personally and had been there a couple of times and was going to QuakeCon and stuff. And he was already a popular draw, but he wasn't on the front page of Stomped at that point. And then sometime in the late 90s, Stomped was bought by a guy from Minnesota again, Gary Arndt, who basically converted the site into a game portal and put Redwood on the front page, and hired Guy as a systems admin. And then another guy, David McDaniel, Tactic, hung out a shingle in, I think, 97 or something, looking for people to help out with the site. And that's when I got involved. It was me and a couple of other people who jumped in at that point. And I think at our peak, we had probably 30 people doing various things on the website. We became a very big network of hosted sites. We were like once we brought on, like we hosted the original Counterstrike.net and PvP Online, which is the very popular webcomic. Scott Kurtz was a friend of Gary's. And we eventually hosted Alakazam, which was an EverQuest database site that was just insane in terms of how much traffic and the size it did. The EverQuest, those EverQuest people were nuts, man. It just was a wild west there in terms of like anytime there was a new item that went up or that was found in the game, there was something created on this site. And I think at our peak, we were doing 50 million dynamically generated pages of content a month with Stomped. And I would actually, like me and Guy Gustafson, were building all this infrastructure out from scratch using FreeBSD in the back end. And we had a rack of servers at US Internet in Minneapolis. And we ended up partnering with CNET. We became their cornerstone site in the Game Center Alliance, and they were advertising us and stuff, and that was kind of funding our growth. And that was fine. That was fine until I think CNET realized that the traffic conversion wasn't working in their favor. We were getting all this traffic, and people were like, "See what? What's this CNET thing?" Nobody was going to CNET, and CNET was paying for their ads on us. And then, I mean, the bottom kind of fell out of it in 2000 and I think 2002 or 2003, but it was fun while it lasted. It was great fun while it lasted. We ended up building a land center in Minneapolis called the Stomping Grounds down in the Warehouse District. We had partnered with Alienware for that, dedicated PCs, and Penguin Computing provided us all our servers. We had like servers for all the popular games and stuff and hosted some LAN parties and stuff like that. And I mean, I don't know. I don't even know if a land center is even a thing anymore in terms of, hey, look at there. So for those who can't see, Pete is holding up a Penguin Computing Penguin right now, which you got if you bought one of their servers. And I haven't seen one of those. Yeah, I haven't seen one of those in probably, was that the first Beyond Unreal server was a Penguin Computing box, was it not?
It absolutely was.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
So I think the big difference between Stomped and Beyond Unreal was that Beyond Unreal was always kind of community first in terms of where it came from. Like it was the forum that was the first, and that was like the jewel was the forum.
Right. So to give a little history leading up to how we ended up meeting, I had first been on Planet Unreal back in the late 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
And actually even before that, I just started a site called Nolly City in 98. And Nolly City, the Nolly were one of the races in the original Unreal game when it first came out. And I noticed there was a need for a site where people can get maps. Okay? Because one of the nice things about the Unreal Engine way back then was that there was a great user community and there were great tools available, excuse me, to create original maps that you could play in. Okay, you can play Capture the Flag in them, or there were all sorts of game types that you could play. But people could create their own maps, and there needed to be a distribution method for those. And this is, you know, prior to, you know, having simple ways of sharing things on the internet. So they had started something on Planet Unreal, and they needed a site administrator. So I started there as a site administrator. I think it was simply to get Nolly City on their site, if I remember correctly at all. And so I did bring Nolly City along, and then we hooked into what they had called File Planet, which was their rudimentary file sharing service, and people could get the maps, and we had a way of getting the maps onto File Planet for people to get. And we did that for a few years, and then the bottom fell out in 2001, the bottom fell out of the gaming internet world, or began to, and all of a sudden they said, well, we can't pay you to do this anymore, because they were actually paying me. And I said, okay, well, and they said, well, if you want to continue doing it, you have to give us all the content. And I said, well, yeah. I really can't do that because the content isn't mine to give. The content, or the big content, was the forums. And the forum content belonged to, as far as I was concerned, the people who posted it. Wasn't mine to give. And so things got a little out of hand there. They said, well, you know, the other thing we can do is, you know, we can give you 30% of the ad revenues. And I said, well, that means I'll have the ability to see what the total ad revenues are. And, you know, I could do an audit of, no. You just have to take our word for it. It's like, no. Yeah. And your third option is to not administer the site anymore. So in the dark of night,
one story's night, great. I love this.
You remember this?
Oh yeah. I remember this. Chris Lambert getting side-eye from the Planet Unreal admin. Like, what's going on? Oh, nothing.
Exactly. In the dark of night, Chris Lambert, who is the person who introduced me to you, and I don't even know how you knew. How did you know Chris, by the way, before we did this?
So we were hosting Counterstrike.net at that point, and Counterstrike.net was using vBulletin as a forum platform.
Ah, gotcha.
And Chris was working for vBulletin, and because, I mean, how better to beta test a forum software than to point more than a million people at it?
Exactly.
And so he
we were
bugs.
Big vBulletin fans back then, and it was easy to work with. Got lots of updates, a lot of security updates, a lot of functional updates, and it was really highly developed at that point in time when forums were really a big deal on the internet. So in the dark of night one night, my buddy Chris, who was also a Planet Unreal admin, downloaded a copy of the entire forums. As he got to the end of that download, his access was cut off quietly, quickly. But we did have a successful download of, I'd say, 99.9% of the forums. And this was the beginning of Beyond Unreal. I had gotten permission from Mark Rain at Epic Games for the domain, which they owned, and he was more than happy to give it to us. He wasn't aware of the shenanigans involved in making this happen. But at the end of the day, we didn't damage anything. We didn't delete anything. We left it all there. We just took a copy because, you know, we're entitled to it just like you are. And I went out and bought myself that Penguin Computing server, which was the one and only server at the time. And we loaded it up with the forum software. And we loaded up the database, and off we went. And as soon as it went up, I got a phone call from Mark Surfas, who at the time was the president and CEO of GameSpy Industries, who threatened to sue me. And I said, "What are you suing me for?" And he said, "Well, for taking those forums." I said, "Well, I didn't take them. You still have them."
Yeah.
And he couldn't argue with me. He says, "Well, that's not your property." I said, "Well, it's not yours either." I said, "Look, let's just you can talk to your lawyers about it, but I don't think I've broken any laws here. I have a copy of them. I'm running them on my own personal server, which I purchased. It's running out of my home." Mm-hmm. At the time, it was on a DSL line of all things. And before we got situated with some server space down in Herndon, Virginia, and some more servers. And I never heard from him again. I guess he did consult his lawyers, and they said, "Well, you know, really, there's no standing here because they didn't really delete anything. They didn't damage anything and blah, 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 blah."
So, had legitimate access.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So, me being a noob, I needed someone to help me. And of course, Chris knew someone who was good at, system operations or sysop stuff, and that was you.
It was me. I remember getting the invite and then popping over onto your IRC channel when IRC was a thing. Is it still a thing?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, that was great. Internet Relay Chat, and we had a channel for this, and I remember joining and meeting everybody, and off we were. We were just off to the races at that point, and it was just a Linux stack with was it Red Hat? I think it was Red Hat at the time. It would have been a Penguin box. It was probably something like that.
Yeah, at the time.
Or CentOS. Yeah, I don't even know if CentOS existed back then. Like, that's the thing. Like, this was the Wild West back then.
It was.
Right? We were all just coding as quickly as we could to build infrastructure for the demand of things. And there was no big meetings. There was no, like, committees. There was just, let's just build this and kind of go and see what happens. And the same thing happened at Stomp.
It was the little guy. In our case, it was the little guy versus the big guy. We didn't want they had demanded that they take the forum content and put it onto their own software, which was horrible. and we were definitely against that. They wanted to add interstitial ads and all sorts of, you know, pop-ups and this and that, and we were all against that. And, you know, early on, I talked to the team and said, look, let's agree on the ad situation. Okay, I'm not looking to make any money off of this, and I never did make any money off of it. It cost me way more money than it ever made. But at the same time, I said, you know, let's do one 468x60 banner ad, and that's it. And that's where we ended up using a thing called PHP ads, if you remember that module. And
I do.
We ended up selling some ads to some companies, and it was great, and helped defray some of the costs, which was great. And I have to thank Epic Games for chipping in with a server one time. They bought us a server when we really needed a server badly, because things were bogging down. And I'm on the phone with you saying, Jason, why is the system usage so high? You're pipe's this big and you're trying to push this much stuff through it. So, okay. Yeah. So we needed to upgrade server and bandwidth capabilities as soon as possible. And
that was the
cool thing was that when we left PU, Planet Unreal, we were doing about 70,000 or so, 72,000 individual unique visitors a day. And by the time we got beyond Unreal to its peak, we were doing the same thing, which was great. And they were doing nothing. They were doing nothing, nothing.
Yeah.
The whole community model works. People don't want to be battling ads and commercialism, and they just want to get to their content. We built a file mirroring system, which worked. You know, we had 5 or 6 file mirrors at the time. This is before it was, again, it was easy to distribute things on the internet. And it was great. We had some in a variety of countries, different sides of the United States. So people who had slow internet access, if they were geographically close to the file mirror, they got much better results for their downloads. And some of these downloads were pretty big, you know, for the times back then. And between the group of us, which I thought was a great team. I mean, we really battled and kept things as secure as we could. We weren't owned too many times. It was pretty interesting.
I don't think anybody ever got in via the operating system.
No.
I don't think anybody ever got root on the server. I think we had a couple of, like, I'm going to call them social ownings with some of our sites with Stomped. We had like this guy who ran a site. His name was Roger. I remember this like it was yesterday. He ran planetquake3.net, and he was in high school, and he literally traded his password for a granola bar.
Oh, dear Lord.
And then his whole site got defaced because somebody logged in and kind of uploaded a whole pile of stuff. And then it was like, dude, why'd you do that? Well, I wanted him to like me.
Oh, geez. Hey, you wrote the news system for us.
I did.
What was that called again? I forget.
Muse, the Malhavex Uber Stomped engine. Right.
There you go.
And then I think I did a version for Beyond Unreal that was a little different. And I know Chris worked on it a little bit too, to make it kind of, because there was like a dynamic templating system he was using for the site that worked better with his stuff. But yeah, I did that out of I don't know what the name of the script was that they were using before on Stomped, but it was horribly unreliable. It was just this PHP. No, I think it was Perl, Perl News or something like that. And it would just crash and you would end up with like an empty page. And then Redwood and J-Cal both wanted things for articles. And then we wanted comments on articles and we wanted comments on news posts and a way to filter and change the date. So I just built this thing out and I was just writing it as I went along, adding features. It was all written in PHP 3. Which was the language at the time. And just based on what Redwood asked me to put in, I put in it and then used something almost exact for Beyond Unreal. And we just changed it with a style sheet to make it look the way it should look.
And it was just a great experience, that whole Planet Unreal before things got nasty Beyond Unreal beginning and getting that going and, you know, making that a success. Because, I mean, Dave Lepore and I got to do the actual launch live on the internet of Unreal Tournament back in 1999. We were actually down in North Carolina for that. We blew up their internet. Didn't have enough internet to cover what we were trying to do there. And so we ended up doing the best we could. But I had a little mini cassette recorder, and I still have the recordings actually of talking with Cliff Buzinski and Steve Polge and Tim Sweeney and different people. And we posted some of those interviews up on Planet Unreal. And those were the good days, you know. And then it was nice that, you know, when we started Beyond Unreal, I got introduced to you by Chris, who ended up being the CTO of Lyft, of all things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really got to say that Chris Lambert, along with you, just two of the smartest people I've ever met. I mean, Chris was like this kid. He was 14 years old, and he was just killing it. I remember the one thing that really raised my eyebrows about Chris is that he won like $3,000 from PayPal because he cracked their security.
Yeah, I remember that now.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And he gave him the solution. You know, he actually engineered a solution for them, a possible solution path, and they implemented it and things were fine.
And those were like the early days of PayPal. It was probably Elon that wrote the check.
It was probably Elon that was responsible for the crap code, but I'm not going to go there.
It could be.
Anyway.
Very well could be. Yeah, I haven't talked to Chris in a long time.
It was a long time. And then, I mean, we were hosting sites on Beyond Unreal by January 2002. We had the full site up and all with a design by a guy named Mix, who actually and ironically worked for GameSpy Industries. I think I paid him $500 to do a whole site design that mm-hmm. was expandable to an enormous 800 by 600 pixels.
And crazy.
He was very cool about it. And the actual site design was pretty nice. I was really impressed with what he was able to come up with mm-hmm. for us.
And, I always liked the color scheme, like that kind of tan with the gray. Always looked so good,
right? And it looked architecturally old and neat. I enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. I still have all the original files, so my kids can throw them out after my demise. Yeah, these were all things we did before the cloud. I mean, there was no cloud back then. You know, it was just you were lucky enough to have some server space. You know, great. I mean, We were lucky because I was just able to get, you know, server space at a true data center in Herndon, Virginia, just for giving out a link, you know, what was used to be called servercave.com. And the guy down there was super, and he would go into the cave when he had to and help us out when we needed somebody on site because something just completely froze up or something. It was great. And then you had the great joy of teaching me how to be a Linux system administrator.
You learned so much so fast, I have to say. I mean, you needed to, right? You were just right there in the fire.
It was a lot. And I have to say too, it gave me a leg up when it came to my career, because I was able to leverage being on Planet Unreal and Beyond Unreal when the opportunity to become the information technology director, along with the quality assurance director at NEAPCO, and eventually hire you as a consultant. Because when I took over the job, I had come back to the company and the engineering department had taken over the Windows side of the networking. And as you might, some people would understand this, is that engineers should not be IT people because they're engineers and they don't understand IT stuff. So on Windows, you have these esoteric permissions that you can apply on a by file basis. So I had a company come in and take a look at the existing file server at the time. And he just threw his hands up and said, I would just throw this all out and start over. He says, the permissions alone are just impossible for Windows to handle in any kind of a graceful manner back then. And then we had you come in and we designed a Linux file server.
We did. We're running Saba.
Yep. We ran Saba. Yeah. You introduced some very super concepts I was not aware of before you called. One of them is a utility called rsync. And rsync was terrific because we ended up, here's some more geeky stuff. We ended up having a two backplane server and we could easily run an rsync from one to two. And it was always available. You know, every 5 minutes, it could just update what was new and mm-hmm. not delete the old stuff,
yeah,
which was super. And then when someone say, oh, Pete, I accidentally deleted XYZ. I hope you have it. You know, I wouldn't have to worry about it, you know, because it was an intraday issue, I would just grab the file off of the other backplane and just scoot it on over, and it was there. And the other thing that really saved the day were you introduced me to something called sticky permissions.
Oh, yes.
So yeah. We were able to create the situation. This is all based on what you taught me, where we had a public area, which was the Wild West. Anything you put there can be deleted by anyone, read by anyone. It's completely out in the open. And then we had departmental shares. And within each departmental share, there was a, this is restricted to just the people in this department. And then this is available for other people to read, but not delete or modify in any way. So we can share departmental stuff as we choose with other people in the organization, because this is the beginning of secrecy is important in business, right? Yes. And then we had the personal shares, which was the, you know, your my documents, basically.
Yeah.
And that's just for you. No one else can see it, of course, other than the system administrators and stuff. And it worked out great. We were able to easily. It took a week. Yeah. Once we got everything where it belonged, it was easy to maintain after that, because the system, the operating system, took care of that based on logins. And I never thought that was something that was even possible. But with the power of Linux.
Right. I still use Samba. I use a Synology now, which is like a big, it's just Linux running on top of Samba, but it's got a kind of commercial interface and stuff. And it's just, they're great. It just works. It just works out of the box. It's no problems with it at all. I'm glad. That was fun. That was a fun trip. Got to meet your kids when they were really, really, really young.
Now they're really, really, really old. And now I have grandchildren.
I was going to ask you, how's that going? How do you feel?
I'm tired. I babysit twice a week, Mondays and Fridays, but it's the best. I never even realized before I met my wife that, you know, and I said this in a previous podcast, that kids were like something that interested me, or family even, because family was always a disaster in my life. And, kids, you know, it's like, the only kid in my life was my sister, and she hates me and we don't speak. So it's a bunch of craziness there. But to be honest with you, I didn't know that, you know, I was cut out for kids. And it turns out they like me and I love them.
Amazing.
Go figure. So yeah. So Liam is my little buddy. He's three now, a little over three. And we have lots of adventures together every week. And he has a hard time sharing me, though, with his little brother now, who's 7 months old. So when the two of us are together, he's not quite understanding that I have to give the little one a little more attention. He doesn't want to share me. So, and it's kind of sweet, but it is difficult at times, but I love it and I wouldn't trade it for anything. And, it's the great gift at the end of one's life is you get to be a grandparent sometimes, you know, and that's one nice thing for me.
Yeah. It's for a variety of reasons. I never ended up having children, and, I'm waiting to see if this decision affects me or bites me in the ass later in life. You know, like when I get to be, say, 80, and I'm like, oh, I wish I had, you know, older kids that could come hang out with me and we could talk about their days and stuff. So I'm trying to ingratiate myself into the neighbor's kids' families right now. Like my neighbor has four, all under the age of five. And they're always on the front lawn. They play with my cats. They like Rose. They like my cars, you know, and I'm always fixing their toys and stuff and their bikes. And it's great. I do have one brother named Todd.
Todd.
And he's my age. He's a little younger than me. We're 11 months apart. And he lives in Toronto. He's a chef.
Oh, okay.
And I saw him briefly back in July when I was up in Toronto covering the Toronto Indy, the IndyCar race. I was up there. Working for Pole Position magazine, and got to see him a little bit, but his hours are so crazy. Like, I don't know if people understand, like when you walk into a restaurant, the kinds of days that people who work in kitchens have, like he goes in usually 2 hours before a shift even starts, just so he can be ready for when his shift starts. And then when the restaurant closes, he's there for at least an hour or two after cleaning up. And he's actually working two jobs right now. He works at a place called Hot Pork.
Hot he gets pork.
An endless of this. It's this kind of bespoke, very small sandwich shop in Toronto. The guy actually smokes his own pork and stuff right out in the alley. He's got a so that's the advertising, right? When you smell when the whole street block smells like delicious roasted meat, everybody comes running. And anyway, he does that for 4 days a week in the morning, and then he works at another place in the evening. So some days when they overlap, it's like a 16-hour day. You know, it's just crazy.
Yeah, it is. But, it's a lot of work, and it's certainly challenging financially, even you know, for a restaurant or a food establishment to make it. What are you doing these days for a living?
So I have a couple of things on the go. I'm still semi-involved with tech. I'm a systems administrator for something called the Public Knowledge Project, which is affiliated with Simon Fraser University out in Vancouver. And we have two sides to the organization. We're a nonprofit. And the first thing we do is we create open source software that we give away for free, which promotes the dissemination of open access publications, like for academics, like monographs, articles, books, academic journals, peer-reviewed content, and stuff like that. So if you are a university or a research institution and you want to publish a journal, you want to publish a book, and you want to give it away, you can use the software that we make to do that for free. You can just download the software, host it yourself. It's all written in PHP and runs on a variety of database platforms. And you can just do that if you want. I worked on the dev team for when I left the university in 2011. I worked on the dev team for that for a couple of years, and was responsible for the first version of what was called Open Monograph Press, which was the version of the software for books. And then I blew up on tech. I disintegrated. I just couldn't do it anymore. I stepped away for a couple of years and started pursuing my other thing, which is photography. And I'm doing that mostly full time now. But I'm also back on a systems side with the Public Knowledge Project, because if you want to use the software, but you don't have the resources, you can pay us to host it for you. And we host roughly 1,000 academic journals at the moment in a variety of companies and organizations around the world. We have there are over 40,000 installations of this software now worldwide, I think. We have conferences and stuff like that. I get to travel for it. I give workshops on how to use it, how to upgrade it, maintain it, back it up. I was in South Africa right before the pandemic happened when everything kind of blew up and we were all trying to get home. That was the very end of 2019, early 2020. Yeah. So that's one thing. And that's a very rewarding part of my life. And it's something that I keep doing. The work is like, it's just when we travel to parts of the world that aren't under the umbrella of like the big, profitable publishers like Elsevier and stuff, we're treated like rock stars. Because like, if you're a researcher in say Africa, and you're only making a couple $100 a year because that's what your salary is, paying a couple $100 as an author fee to submit a paper to an academic journal that publishes in, say, Germany is just a non-starter. So you can use our software to do that for free and then make your research available as open access so anybody can do it. And like, you know, like research is taxpayer funded. So taxpayers should have access to research. They should have access to the stuff that they're paying for and use it for the benefit of humanity. And that's kind
boy,
of
boy, do I agree with you? My goodness.
Yeah. So that's kind of the Public Knowledge Project, right? That's our mandate. We do that. And then the other thing, of course, is the photography. I've been a photographer now for probably 25 years. I started doing landscape work, which pulled me into travel, and I've now been to 95 countries, that's in no small part thanks to Gary Arndt, the guy that paid the bill for Stomped way back in the day, because when the bottom fell out of Stomped, he started traveling, and I think he's still on the road. He runs a website called everythingeverywhere.com, and I think he's like 100 in some countries now and has a blog and a podcast, and he's been on... I bumped into him completely randomly on a flight from Vienna to Macedonia one time in 2015. I was just sitting in my seat and Gary walks on. I was like, dude, what's going on? He's like, what are you doing? I said, well, clearly I'm going to Macedonia. That was just a weird random encounter. But yeah, so I do that. Like I love where I live, but I have to diversify as a photographer. If you want to make a living at it, it's just that's just how it is for an artist. So I do fine art landscape. I exhibit at some galleries in New Brunswick and around Canada. I teach at a craft college. I come in a couple of times a year and I lecture in a variety of classrooms, one of them being a professional practice class at the College of Craft and Design here. I come in like, so you want to be an artist? Okay, great. How do you make a living at it? These are the things that you need to do to be profitable and to get clients and to run a business and pay your taxes and all that stuff. And I help out with that. I do motorsport work, and that's the real passionate stuff that I'm into. Like that's turned into so many cool opportunities. Like I cover something called Stage Rally, which is a very underground form of motorsport in North America primarily. Although once you get into it and you realize how popular it is for those who know what it is, it's kind of hard to not become addicted. There's two series. There's the American Rally Association Championship Series, and then there's the Canadian Rally Championship up here in Canada. Some of these rallies have 50 plus years of history. Every single year they just run these things. Ojibwe Rally just finished in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota on the weekend. And that's led me, I've been all over North America for that. I drive to these events. I drove to Idaho in 2018 for a weekend from where I live in Eastern Canada, which was kind of stupid. Shouldn't have done that, but I did.
Definitely would have taken a flight in that one.
Yeah, it was like a 7,000-mile road trip just to go and hang out for a weekend in the woods of Idaho.
And you're coming down my way soon, aren't you?
I am, yeah, because of something else I do. I cover, for whatever reason, I've become the photographer for Subaru of America's series of festivals called SubiFest. And the next one is in York, Pennsylvania, the weekend of the, I want to say the 14th, 15th of September. So I'll be coming in, I think on the Friday before that, on the 12th, I fly into Washington and I rent a car. Washington just happened to be the cheapest airport. I'm going to be in Montreal the week before. So I'll just fly from Montreal to Washington and then drive up. And then I'm in New York, I think 3 days, and then back to Washington and fly out. Yeah. And I drove through Allentown last summer because Rose and I did the road trip. We were going to go down. I was like, let's just drive to Boxerfest. How bad could it be? And she's like, are you sure? It's like, sure. So seven states later, we're still driving. Maine is huge, by the way. I don't think if anybody's ever driven through Maine really understands how big a state can be when you drive it from north to south. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like 6 hours later in your road trip and you're still in Maine. But yeah, so we did that last year. And
People do the same. They have the same reaction when they drive from east to west or west to east in Pennsylvania. It's like, it's 6 hours and now I'm in Pittsburgh. Okay.
You know. Yeah, it's a big state. It's a big state. It's kind of like, well, it's like Canadian provinces too. Like everybody's like, oh, Texas is huge. You can fit two states the size of Texas in Quebec.
Yeah.
You know, it's big. It's like Ontario is a 3-day drive to get across it. Just,
jeez.
You know, and it's the, you start getting sick of looking at the Canadian Shield. It's just rocks and trees for like 2,000 miles, but.
Well, last year when you came, there were band things going on and I couldn't do the meetup. And now it turns out that I'm having a debut with my new band on the 12th.
Amazing. That's the Friday.
Yeah, on the 12th. The 13th, I'm not doing anything. And then the 14th, I have a picnic with the band because it's a getting to know you situation where this is a new band and new people. And the fellow who runs it wants us to get together and to bond. So he's actually seems to be concerned about, you know, people getting along as well as, you know, playing music together. So I've been spending the last 3 weeks minus a week of vacation just learning 75 new songs to play. And it's a bit challenging jamming them all in my old addled brain. But we're getting there. And I think I have one more to learn. And then I just need to sharpen up on all of them. Make sure they all sound professional, because this is a big step up from my last gig.
Is it the same style of music, same genre?
It's similar. It's cover tunes. That's the similarity, but it's not. We're not playing like Mustang Sally and, you know, Allman Brothers. We're playing more danceable rock music and some disco and some danceable country. And
okay,
it's kind of an upbeat thing.
So I still watch the video. This is still the coolest thing you have ever done.
Okay.
Of Mecca covering Wasted Years by Iron Maiden. I still watch that. Like, it's still a thing. dude.
Yeah, that's
I mean,
long time ago, dude.
Like when you reached out to me way back in 2001, I was like, let's just check and see if this guy's cool. And I Googled it. I was like, Pete Kemmerer, cool. And then this YouTube video, it's like, well, right on. Okay. He likes Maiden. Awesome. We're in. No problem.
Yeah. I can still play it. Yeah. It's been a while, but I can still play it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those were good days. And interestingly enough, Jason, the guitarist, one of the guitarists in that video, not the one doing the main solo, the other one that's closer to me on the stage, I'm in the band with him now.
Oh, that's outstanding.
35 years later, we come full circle and Jack Weand and I are in the same band again. And so when I did the audition and I got the gig, I went to see him another band. We went to see a band play and he showed up and I said, so they outvoted you on having me in the band. He just laughed, but no, it's going really well. And these are all excellent musicians, and I'm looking forward to the debut, so it should be a lot of fun. Yeah,
that's outstanding.
Yeah. So, and you mentioned being to almost 100 countries. I mean, traveling was always important in your life. I mean, you enjoy traveling and seeing these new places. Photography aside.
Yeah, like travel, and this is the thing, the takeaway point for anybody who asks me why I travel. It's just like it gives you an insight into, like, because we all read the news. Right.
Yeah.
And you look at stuff happening like anywhere in the world. It doesn't really matter, good or bad. And you're like, I don't know how I should feel about this or how am I connected to this. But like when you actually go to a place, two things happen. One, you develop insights into a spot because you've been there and you have a more informed opinion on anything going on because you can say, okay, I remember seeing that or I've been there or I've talked to people who live there and I have additional insight. And also it makes you appreciate what you have back home a whole lot. Like, I mean, I couldn't tell you how happy I was to be able to go to a tap and get a glass of water after I got back from Vietnam. I was going to Vietnam for a month in 2009. I was working on a project with Lonely Planet and I was traveling from Ho Chi Minh City in the south up to Hanoi and I was taking night trains. So I would, like, just to avoid paying for hotels, I would just get on a train and travel overnight. And then get off and then explore and then get back on a train and stuff. But like the people were telling me, like, don't drink the water. It's like, really? It's like, yeah, we don't even drink the water. Don't drink the water. Get the bottled water. I'm like, okay. And just to not be able to do that was eye opening, you know? To be able to come home and then just have water. You really appreciate the little things in life. Also, I will never again complain about traffic in Fredericton, driving around in traffic. Like, I mean, I was in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago for a Subaru event in Pasadena. And I remember I landed, it was like 11 o'clock at night on a Friday and traffic was still bumper to bumper going out to Pasadena. And that was nuts. And like, and even now, like I can close my eyes and I can still hear the horns honking from my time in Beirut, back in 2010. Just driving around in Lebanon and stuff. And just like, it's a free for all. It's just Mad Max on some of these roads. And I was like, I'll never complain about traffic in Fredericton. It's like, oh, you have to wait 10 minutes to get where you need to go. That's fair. That's cute. That's fun.
That's cute.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, well, I haven't done the traveling you have, but I will say that just being in the gaming world, you know, back then it did introduce me to one thing that still remains clear in my mind for the most part is that, we would deal with people from all over the world. That was my first experience, like being involved with people from all over the world. And they were in Australia. They were in South Korea. They were in Russia. They were in a variety of countries all over the world. And what I learned there was the people are in general, very nice. They're great to talk to you. Great to be around.
One of the things I love about the work I do, especially the festival work, is just the genuine enthusiasm that everybody has for what everybody else is doing in the car community, right? Like if you go to any Subaru event, everybody is there because they are there simply because they love the brand and what people are doing within the brand. And Subaru shows up with all of their philanthropic stuff, right? Like they're not just a car company, right? They do stuff with Feed America. They do stuff with the SPCA. They do stuff with Make-A-Wish Foundation. 40 million meals they donated for Feed America this year alone.
That's awesome.
They've rebuilt schools. And like they bring all this stuff, right? And then you can find out about it. And you're like, what? You're not just a car company. You're this philanthropic enterprise with all of this cool stuff on the go. And you can adopt a pet. You can go to the show and find a dog and leave. And you can, it's more than just people doing burnouts in a parking lot. Like we had 10 million people, no, sorry, 10 million people, 10,000 people at Wicked Big Meat in Connecticut in June. And it's in a small town called Stafford Springs, Connecticut, population of about 2,000. And we were five times bigger than the town, and there's only one pizza place, and they only take cash. And it was a bananas day. It was just like 10,000 very highly modified Subarus rolling through the town. It was like one of these motorcycle festivals that you hear about, you know, and they all leave, and it's just, the city's like, well, they can come back next year. So yeah, I got this one coming up in Pennsylvania, and then I have one in Chicago at the end of September, and then one in Dallas in late October. And then the last one is right before Christmas in Orlando. Yep. Subifest Florida.
Now, do you own a car?
I do. I have two Subarus at the moment, but there was a period in my life when I did not own a car.
I remember that keeping your carbon footprint very small was very important to you back in the day.
Yeah, it still is. I can only drive one of them at a time. So there was that. And one of them is kind of a weekend car, and I have a daily driver. I work from home. Like, I think I drive maybe 1,500 miles a year.
Yeah.
You know?
Very limited.
Like, Fredericton, the city I live in, is about 50,000 people, I think. And you can walk from one side to the other in about a half hour. Okay. And there's 100 kilometers, so like what, 60 miles worth of multi-use trails throughout the city. You can walk anywhere without even setting foot on a public street if you want. And we have all of these great pubs and microbreweries and restaurants and stuff. And it's a lovely place to live. Really quiet, quaint. And if you drive through New Brunswick on the highway, you would never know, because the Trans-Canada doesn't even come close to it. It's just, that's it. You know, you get the one sign that says exit to Fredericton, and then you come into the city, and it's lovely. Quiet. Yeah.
And I never made it up there, and I should have, and I always wanted to, and then things, you know, life happens, you know. Mm-hmm. I guess there's still the possibility. I know. One of the great things that happened to you post Beyond Unreal was meeting the lovely Rose.
Yes,
a lady in your life who has obviously made you a better man, because look at you. How did the two of you meet?
Rose is an example of what happens when you're done looking and good things just come naturally. So I was in
Boy,
Iceland.
Am I familiar with that.
Right? Right?
Completely.
So I listened to the last episode of the episode before, and you were talking about how you met Denise. And yeah, it's just, you know, this was a similar story. I had been divorced for about 7 years at this point. I got married when I was really young, and my first wife and I split up in 2006. And I spent that was when I was like, okay, time to rebuild and reinvent and put down the foundation for what will be the rest of my life. And I became super strict and super disciplined, and I didn't cut myself any slack. Sold my car, did all that stuff, started traveling. Put all this stuff up in place in my life, right? It's like, I'm not going to cut any corners. And then spent like a couple of years doing that, and had assumed that I was probably going to leave Fredericton at one point or another, because at that point I wasn't working for the university anymore. I was traveling a lot. I wanted to be closer to a bigger international airport, et cetera. And I was in Iceland. I had just spent a month in Iceland, hiking in Iceland. And when I got back to Reykjavik, I started scrolling through my emails, and I had a note from a lovely, lovely lady named Joanna Andow, now Joanna Kerr. She got married. The title of the email was, "When are you back?" And I looked at it. And the only thing the message said was, "There's somebody you should probably meet." That's all she said. And I'm like, okay, fine. And I wrote her back. I said, "I'm back in a couple of days. Let me know." I already started selling my stuff. Like, my house was getting pretty empty. I was selling furniture. My brother would come in, and he would stand in my living room, and he would, "This is Sparta." I didn't even have a Like my coffee table was gone. My couch was gone. Anyway, I got back and I met, I was introduced to this lovely lady that I'm now with named Rose Morton. And Rose was at the time back in Fredericton for about a year. She's originally from New Brunswick and she was living with her sister after moving back home from Calgary. She had been a librarian out in Calgary, working at the Calgary Public Library. Her thing was always outreach and getting marginalized families and underprivileged kids into books to make sure that they always had access to education and books and that kind of thing, because that stuff early on in life is super foundational and very important to her. That's her passion. And she was back home and she was just getting her life back on track in Fredericton, and we went for coffee. And it went really well. You know, we had a 2-hour, they ended up, the coffee shop was closing as we were still sitting at our table. They were sweeping around the bottom of our chair and just kind of like, you guys are going to have to go someplace else. Like, get the hell out of here kind of thing. So we left and I said goodbye and she gave me a hug. And then I went to Mexico for 2 weeks. And when I got back, we just started hanging out more and more. And it just kind of organically morphed into like this wonderful relationship. There was never any pressure. It's not like we ever really like decided that, okay, we were friends and now we're together as a couple. It was just this thing that became what it is. After about a year, she moved in, and she's responsible for like most of the positive things that have happened in my life in the last, we've been together 12 years now. It was 12 years in August 11th.
That's so awesome.
Yeah. And it's just, I wasn't looking and neither was she, right? We were just getting our lives back on track and doing things that were important to us. The things that make you interesting to other people and make you feel good about yourself, right? The idea is to have so much stuff going on in your life that is positive, that it spills over into other people's lives around you. That's kind of the thing that you try to do, right? And that's what happened. Like, she went back to school a couple of years ago. She did her master's in library information science from the University of Alberta. Did it remotely and is now working at the downtown branch of the Fredericton Public Library here in town and is really happy, just really good at what she does, loves her job, and has really, really built a life for herself here. And we're just really happy. It's been great, you know?
It's great.
Yeah.
Parallels between you and Rose and the circumstances of you getting together and how that all happened and the organic aspect of it. You know, just reminded me a lot of how Denise and I got together. And, you know, we've had a 32-year marriage now. And, you know, I mean, I was feral when I met her, pretty much. I mean, it was kind of sad. And I met her in the same way. I just stopped looking. Yeah. I stopped thinking that I had all the answers. I decided I would just focus in on, all right, I'll make money and, you know, professionally try to improve myself. And I stopped looking at all. And then, you know, I was introduced to her and it's like, as much as I didn't want to go out with her, the moment I did, it was like, oh, wow, this is great. Oh, now what?
Yeah. I was like, okay, sure. Yeah. But you could pass along my email address, you know? And then we met, we bonded over playing Portal on the Xbox. I used to go up and she was her sister's husband had an Xbox. I don't know which one it was, but anyway, we were playing Portal on the couch, just sitting there and like trying to figure out these puzzles. And it was just a really good kind of wholesome organic time. And she had two nieces that would run around and I was just, it was just a great, like what a great time, you know, in life just to not have any pressure on it, to not expect anything, to just let it just see where it goes, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like all of that is lost now, I think, with like things like dating apps and whatnot. And it's just, there's an expectation of stuff and it's just,
I would hate to be single in today's world. I really would.
Yeah. Me too.
You know, I really do, over time, I won't kid you, being married is difficult. Especially when you've been married as long as we have, you know, it's not free. You have to work at it. It ran into challenging situations. I learned a lot from her. I hope I've taught her a few things too, but you never know. And it's been great. So I'm really glad that you and Rose found each other, because it's just finding each other, happenstance, whatever. You have a friend. I had a brother-in-law, future brother-in-law, introduce us. That's half the battle right there. And then, you know, realizing what you have once you get it. And that, you know, this, I really like being with this person. I'm just going to be with this person more, you know, why not, you know, enjoy each other. And then just one thing leads to another, and there you go. I wanted to thank you not only for being on the podcast, but I don't think anybody is successful in the world without having people around them that help them. And you've helped me in so many different ways, professionally and personally, that I can't even begin to pay you back. I mean, or even to tell you everything you've done for me. I mean, there was a time where I loved the computer stuff. I loved the doing that stuff, but I was not good at it. And you just came into my life and taught me so much. And I was able to take that and I leveraged that into a whole new job, basically, when that became available at NEAPCO Incorporated here in Pottstown when it was located here. And it was unusually effective. I mean, I was able to do things that I never would have been able to do without you in my life. And I certainly appreciate that. The whole Beyond Unreal thing was not going to happen without you and Chris, you know, and also the other people on the site that worked with us. Hal did all that news posting. I'm forgetting so many names because it's been 20 years, but there was a whole team of people who volunteered just to be a part of this. No one got paid. I mean, we just did it, and we did it to basically, hey, the man, you know, and have some fun. And we had a great time, and we were valued by Epic Games themselves. I know that for a fact. And it was a good time for everybody. And I know it impressed my kids. It got my kids into gaming. It got my nephew into gaming. They're still doing it, you know, and, I remember having my young son, Todd, who's now going to be 35 this year, up here in this room, sitting right back here where my bass guitars are, and sitting at a little desk. And the first time that I put him in front of that when he was 9 years old, and I turned on Unreal. And, you know, the beginning of Unreal, you walk up that platform and you walk forward on this platform that has this green gloppy goop falling off. And all of a sudden the monster goes, and watching him shake, physically shake. And then I said, okay, Todd, that's enough for now. Cause it was so realistic back then, you know?
Yeah.
And, but that was like, daddy, I love this. I love games. Let's play more games. And then, you know, before too long, he was beating me. And that all started, you know, because of people like you in my life that made all this a reality. I mean, Unreal was nothing to me.
And Todd played me. I played against Todd. I played against Todd in that same room.
Yeah. He became a real killer, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I never got to play Quake against him, though. It would have been different, but
I'm sure. So anyway, thank you so much for all of that and for helping me out with the NEAPCO stuff and for being my friend. And for doing this podcast, I think everybody should know people like you. You're a good man. You're a good person. You were not afraid to reinvent yourself. You know, you had gone down a road where you were, like you were saying, very strict with yourself. You were very controlling of everything in your life. And you realized that, well, maybe that's not the way to be completely. Maybe there's got to be some room for some flexibility, some softness, some, you know, other things, you know? So while you have a discipline and you're a disciplined person, you know, there's also the other side of you that you invite in now, which is great.
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, like, and likewise, like, man, like our friendship has just been one of the more rewarding and enriching aspects of my life. Like it's weird how time goes by, you know, like I still see your posts online. I'm not on Facebook very much anymore, but I still check in and like I read your stuff and like I think very fondly on like all the things that we like the things that we shared over the years. And you don't have to thank me because just being your friend is thanks enough.
Jeez, thanks.
You know, I'm like,
you're going to make me cry. Stop.
Your family's lovely. You know? Yeah. I don't need to cry, Pete. Yeah. But, you know, and I'm glad to have known them. I'm glad to have met them. You know, dude, like that's just, those are all really important things in my life. So thank you.
Yeah. And let's, let's sign off by just hoping that maybe some sanity comes to this world and we can all start being better with each other.
It would.
Anyway, now that I'm leaking eye fluids, that does wrap up another episode of Pete's Pup. I hope you enjoyed today's show with Jason. Jason's just one of those interesting people that you should all get to know. If you have any comments about it or suggestions for the podcast, or you'd like to be a guest on the show and make me cry, you can drop me an email at peter.kemmerer@gmail.com. It's my real email address, not a forwarder. I'm always interested to talk with people with stories to tell. The theme music for today's Pete's Pub is Hard Fought Victory by Chris Martin and Jeff Harvey at www.purple-planet.com. And until next time, remember, if you can be a bass player like me, be one. If you can't, date or marry one. Thank you very much. See you soon.